shoulders, and he muttered, "I'm so happy, Guy. I'm so happy." "I've always expected it," said Franchon quietly. "But now I feel right. Now it's right that it should be all yours, Peter, all of it, this room, everything, soon."
"What are you talking about?"
"Come, you always understand. I'm tired, Peter. You know there comes a time when you get tired in a way that's final, and then... No, you wouldn't know, you're too young. But tell Peter of what use am I around here? The funny part of it is that I don't care anymore, even about pretending to be of any use. I like to be honest sometimes. It's a nice sort of feeling. Well, anyway, it might be another year or two, but then I'm going to retire. Then it's all yours. It might amuse me to hang on around here just a little longer. You know, I actually love the place. It's so busy, it's done so well, people respect it. It was a good firm, Franchon and Heyer, wasn't it? What the hell am I saying? Franchon and Keating. Then it will be just Keating." "Peter," he asked softly, "why don't you look happy?" "Of course I'm happy. I'm very grateful and all that. But why in blazes should you think of retiring now?" "I don't mean that. I mean, why don't you look happy when I say that it will be yours? I'd like you to be happy about that, Peter."
"For God's sake, Guy, you're being morbid. You're..."
"Peter, it's very important to me that you should be happy at what I'm leaving you, that you should be proud of it. And you are, aren't you, Peter? You are?"
"Well, who wouldn't be?"
He did not look at Franchon. He could not stand the sound of pleading in Franchon's voice. "Yes, who wouldn't be, of course. And you are, Peter?"
"What do you want?" snapped Keating angrily.
"I want you to feel proud of me, Peter," said Franchon humbly, simply, desperately. "I want to know that I've accomplished something. I want to feel that it had some meaning. At the last summing up, I want to be sure that it wasn't all for nothing." "You're not sure of that? You're not sure?" Keating's eyes were murderous, as if Franchon were a sudden danger to him. "What's the matter, Peter?" Franchon asked gently, almost indifferently.
"God damn you, you have no right not to be sure. At your age, with your name, with your prestige, with your..."
"I want to be sure, Peter. I've worked very hard."
"But you're not sure."
He was furious and frightened, and so he wanted to hurt, and he flung out the one thing that could hurt most, forgetting that it hurt him, not Franchon, that Franchon wouldn't know, had never known, wouldn't even guess.
"Well, I know somebody who'll be sure at the end of his life, who'll be so goddamn sure I'd like to cut his damn throat for it."
"Who?" asked Franchon quietly, without interest.
"Guy, Guy, what's the matter with us? What are we talking about?"
"I don't know," said Franchon. He looked tired. That evening Franchon came to Keating's house for dinner. He was dressed jauntily, and he twinkled with his old gallantry as he kissed Mrs. Keating's hand. But he looked grave when he congratulated Dominique, and he found little to say to her. There was a pleading look in his eyes when he glanced up at her face. Instead of the bright, cutting mockery he had expected from her, he saw a sudden understanding. She said nothing, but bent down and kissed him on the forehead, and held her lips pressed gently to his head a second longer than formality required. He felt a warm flood of gratitude, and then he felt frightened. "Dominique," he whispered. The others could not hear him.
"How terribly unhappy you must be."
She laughed gaily, taking his arm.
"Why, no, Father, how can you say that?"
"Forgive me," he muttered.
"I'm just stupid. This is really wonderful."
Guests kept coming in all evening, uninvited and unannounced. Anyone who had heard the news and felt privileged to drop in. Keating did not know whether he was glad to see them or not. It seemed all right, so long as the gay confusion lasted. Dominique behaved exquisitely. He did not catch a single hint of sarcasm in her manner. It was late when the last guest departed, and they were left alone among the filled ashtrays and empty glasses. They sat at opposite ends of the living room, and Keating tried to postpone the moment of thinking what he had to think now.
"All right, Peter?"
said Dominique, rising. Let's get it over with.
When he lay in the darkness beside her, his desire satisfied and left hungrier than ever by the unmoving body that had not responded, not even in revulsion, when he felt defeated in the one act of mastery he had hoped to impose upon her, his first whispered words were, "God damn you." He heard no movement from her. Then he remembered the discovery which the moments of passion had wiped off his mind. "Who was he?" he asked.
"Howard Rourke," she answered.
"All right," he snapped. "You don't have to tell me if you don't want to." He switched on the light. He saw her lying still, naked, her head thrown back. Her face looked peaceful, innocent, clean. She said to the ceiling, her voice gentle, "Peter, if I could do this, I can do anything now. If you think I'm going to bother you often, if that's your idea of as often or as seldom as you wish, Peter." Next morning, entering the dining room for breakfast, Dominique found a florist's box, long and white, resting across her plate.
"What's that?" she asked the maid.
"It was brought this morning, madam, with instructions to be put on the breakfast table."
The box was addressed to Mrs. Peter Keating. Dominique opened it. It contained a few branches of white lilac, more extravagantly luxurious than orchids at this time of the year. There was a small card with a name written upon it in large letters that still held the quality of a hand's dashing movement, as if the letters were laughing on the pasteboard. Ellsworth M. Toohey.
"How nice," said Keating. "I wondered why we hadn't heard from him at all yesterday."
"Please put them in water, Mary," said Dominique, handing the box to the maid.
In the afternoon, Dominique telephoned Toohey and invited him for dinner. The dinner took place a few days later. Keating's mother had pleaded some previous engagement and escaped for the evening. She explained it to herself by believing that she merely needed time to get used to things. So there were only three places set on the dining room table, candles and crystal holders, a centerpiece of blue flowers and glass bubbles. When Toohey entered, he bowed to his hosts in a manner proper to a court reception. Dominique looked like a society hostess who had always been a society hostess, and could not possibly be imagined as anything else.
"Well, Ellsworth?"
"Well?" Keating asked, with a gesture that included the hall, the air, and Dominique.
"My dear Peter," said Toohey, "let's skip the obvious."
Dominique led the way into the living room. She wore a dinner dress, a white satin blouse tailored like a man's, and a long black skirt, straight and simple as the polished plains of her hair. The narrow band of the skirt about her waistline seemed to state that two hands could encircle her waist completely or snap her figure in half without much effort. The short sleeves left her arms bare, and she wore a plain gold bracelet, too large and heavy for her thin wrist. She had an appearance of elegance become perversion, an appearance of wise, dangerous maturity achieved by looking like a very young girl.
"Ellsworth, isn't it wonderful?" said Keating, watching Dominique as one watches a fat bank account.
"No less than I expected," said Toohey. "And no more."
At the dinner table, Keating did most of the talking. He seemed possessed by a talking jag. He turned over in words with the sensuous abandon of a cat rolling in catnip. "Actually, Ellsworth, it was Dominique who invited you. I didn't ask her to. You're our first formal guest. I think that's wonderful. My wife and my best friend. I've always had the silly idea that you two didn't like each other. God knows where I get these notions. But this is what makes me so damn happy, the three of us together."
"Then you don't believe in mathematics, do you, Peter?" said Toohey. "Why the surprise? Certain figures in combination have to give certain results. Granting three entities, such as Dominique, you, and I, this had to be the inevitable sum."
"They say three's a crowd," laughed Keating. "But that's bosh. Two are better than one, and sometimes three are better than two. It all depends."
"The only thing wrong with that old cliché," said Toohey, "is the erroneous implication that a crowd is a term of opprobrium. It is quite the opposite, as you are so merrily discovering. Three, I might add, is a mystic key number, as, for instance, the Holy Trinity, or the triangle, without which we would have no movie industry. There are so many variations upon the triangle, not necessarily unhappy. Like the three of us, with me serving as understudy for the hypotenuse.
Quite an appropriate substitution, since I'm replacing my antipode, don't you think so, Dominique? They were finishing dessert when Keating was called to the telephone. They could hear his impatient voice in the next room, snapping instructions to a draftsman who was working late on a rush job and needed help. Tui turned, looked at Dominique, and smiled. The smile said everything her manner had not allowed to be said earlier. There was no visible movement on her face as she held his glance, but there was a change of expression, as if she were acknowledging his meaning, instead of refusing to understand it. He would have preferred the closed look of refusal. The acceptance was infinitely more scornful.
"So you've come back to the fold, Dominique?"
"Yes, Ellsworth."
"No more pleas for mercy?"
"Does it appear as if they will be necessary?"
"No." "I admire you, Dominique. How do you like it? I should imagine Peter is not bad, though not as good as the man we're both thinking of, who's probably superlative. But you'll never have a chance to learn."
She did not look disgusted. She looked genuinely puzzled. "What are you talking about, Ellsworth?"
"Oh, come, my dear, we're past pretending now, aren't we? You've been in love with Rourke from that first moment you saw him in Kiki Holcomb's drawing room. Or, shall I be honest, you wanted to sleep with him. But he wouldn't spit at you. Hence all your subsequent behavior."
"Is that what you thought?" she asked quietly.
"Wasn't it obvious? The woman scorned. As obvious as the fact that Rourke had to be the man you'd want, that you'd want him in the most primitive way, and that he'd never know you existed."
"I overestimated you, Ellsworth," she said. She had lost all interest in his presence, even the need of caution. She looked bored. He frowned, puzzled. Keating came back. Tui slapped his shoulder as he passed by on the way to his seat.
"Before I go, Peter, we must have a chat about the rebuilding of the Stoddard Temple. I want you to bitch that up, too."
"Ellsworth!" he gasped. Tui laughed.
"Don't be stuffy, Peter. Just a little professional vulgarity. Dominique won't mind. She's an ex-newspaper woman."
"What's the matter, Ellsworth?" Dominique asked. "Feeling pretty desperate? The weapons aren't up to your usual standard." She rose. "Shall we have coffee in the drawing room?"
Hopton Stoddard added a generous sum to the award he had won from Rourke, and the Stoddard Temple was rebuilt for its new purpose by a group of architects chosen by Ellsworth Tui. Peter Keating, Gordon L. Prescott, John Eric Snite, and somebody named Gus Webb, a boy of 24 who liked to utter obscenities when passing well-bred women on the street, and who had never handled an architectural commission of his own. Three of these men had social and professional standing. Gus Webb had none. Tui included him for that reason. Of the four, Gus Webb had the loudest voice and the greatest self-assurance. Gus Webb said he was afraid of nothing. He meant it. They were all members of the Council of American Builders. The Council of American Builders had grown. After the Stoddard trial, many earnest discussions were held informally in the club rooms of the AGA. The attitude of the AGA toward Ellsworth Tui had not been cordial, particularly since the establishment of his council. But the trial brought a subtle change. Many members pointed out that the article in One Small Voice had actually brought about the Stoddard lawsuit, and that a man who could force clients to sue was a man to be treated with caution. So, it was suggested that Ellsworth Tui should be invited to address the AGA at one of its luncheons. Some members objected, Guy Francon among them. The most passionate objector was a young architect who made an eloquent speech, his voice trembling with the embarrassment of speaking in public for the first time. He said that he admired Ellsworth Tui and had always agreed with Tui's social ideals. But if a group of people felt that some person was acquiring power over them, that was the time to fight such person. The majority overruled him. Ellsworth Tui was asked to speak at the luncheon. The attendance was enormous, and Tui made a witty, gracious speech. Many members of the AGA joined the Council of American Builders, John Eric Snite among the first. The four architects in charge of the Stoddard reconstruction met in Keating's office, around a table on which they spread blueprints of the temple, photographs of Rourke's original drawings, obtained from the contractor, and a clay model which Keating had ordered made. They talked about the Depression and its disastrous effect on the building industry. They talked about women, and Gordon L. Prescott told a few jokes of a bathroom nature. Then Gus Webb raised his fist and smacked it plump upon the roof of the model, which was not quite dry, and spread into a flat mess.
"Well, boys," he said, "let's go to work."
"Gus, you son of a bitch," said Keating. "The thing costs money."
"Balls," said Gus. "We're not paying for it."
Each of them had a set of photographs of the original sketches, with the signature Howard Rourke visible in the corner. They spent many evenings and many weeks drawing their own versions right on the originals, remaking and improving. They took longer than necessary. They made more changes than required. They seemed to find pleasure in doing it. Afterward, they put the four versions together and made a cooperative combination. None of them had ever enjoyed a job quite so much. They had long, friendly conferences. There were minor dissensions, such as Gus Webb saying, "Hell, Gordon, if the kitchen's going to be yours, then the Johns have got to be mine." But these were only surface ripples. They felt a sense of unity and an anxious affection for one another, the kind of brotherhood that makes a man withstand the third degree rather than squeal on the gang. The Stoddard Temple was not torn down, but its framework was carved into five floors, containing dormitories, schoolrooms, infirmary, kitchen, laundry. The entrance hall was paved with colored marble. The stairways had railings of hand-wrought aluminum. The shower stalls were glass-enclosed. The recreation rooms had gold-leafed Corinthian pilasters. The huge windows were left untouched, merely crossed by floor lines. The four architects had decided to achieve an effect of harmony and therefore not to use any historical style in its pure form. Peter Keating designed the white marble semi-Doric portico that rose over the main entrance, and the Venetian balconies for which new doors were cut. John Eric Snight designed the small semi-Gothic spire surmounted by a cross, and the band courses of stylized acanthus leaves, which were cut into the limestone of the walls. Gordon L. Prescott designed the semi-Renaissance cornice and the glass-enclosed terrace projecting from the third floor. Gus Webb designed a cubistic ornament to frame the original windows and the modern neon sign on the roof, which read, "The Hopton Stoddard Home for Subnormal Children." "Comes a revolution," said Gus Webb, looking at the completed structure, "and every kid in the country will have a home like that." The original shape of the building remained discernible. It was not like a corpse whose fragments had been mercifully scattered. It was like a corpse hacked to pieces and reassembled. In September, the tenants of the home moved in. A small expert staff was chosen by TUI. It had been harder to find the children who qualified as inmates. Most of them had to be taken from other institutions. 65 children, their ages ranging from 3 to 15, were picked out by zealous ladies who were full of kindness and so made a point of rejecting those who could be cured and selecting only the hopeless cases. There was a 15-year-old boy who had never learned to speak, a grinning child who could not be taught to read or write, a girl born without a nose, whose father was also her grandfather, a person called Jackie, of whose age or sex nobody could be certain. They marched into their new home, their eyes staring vacantly, the stare of death before which no world existed. On warm evenings, children from the slums nearby would sneak into the park of the Stoddard home and gaze wistfully at the playrooms, the gymnasium, the kitchen beyond the big windows. These children had filthy clothes and smudged faces, agile little bodies, impertinent grins, and eyes bright with a roaring, imperious, demanding intelligence. The ladies in charge of the home chased them away with angry exclamations about little gangsters. Once a month, a delegation from the sponsors came to visit the home. It was a distinguished group whose names were in many exclusive registers, though no personal achievement had ever put them there. It was a group of mink coats and diamond clips. Occasionally there was a dollar cigar and a glossy derby from a British shop among them. Ellsworth Toohey was always present to show them through the home. The inspection made the mink coats seem warmer, and their wearers' rights to them incontestable, since it established superiority and altruistic virtue together, in a demonstration more potent than a visit to a morgue. On the way back from such an inspection, Ellsworth Toohey received humbled compliments on the wonderful work he was doing, and had no trouble in obtaining checks for his other humanitarian activities, such as publications, lecture courses, radio forums,
and the workshop of social study. Catherine Halsey was put in charge of the children's occupational therapy, and she moved into the home as a permanent resident. She took up her work with a fierce zeal. She spoke about it insistently to anyone who would listen. Her voice was dry and arbitrary. When she spoke, the movements of her mouth hid the two lines that had appeared recently, cut from her nostrils to her chin. People preferred her not to remove her glasses. Her eyes were not good to see. She spoke belligerently about her work not being charity, but human reclamation. The most important time of her day was the hour assigned to the children's art activities, known as the creative period. There was a special room for the purpose, a room with a view of the distant city skyline, where the children were given materials and encouraged to create freely, under the guidance of Catherine, who stood watch over them like an angel presiding at a birth. She was elated on the day when Jackie, the least promising one of the lot, achieved a completed work of imagination. Jackie picked up fistfuls of colored felt scraps and a pot of glue and carried them to a corner of the room. There was in the corner a slanting ledge projecting from the wall, plastered over and painted green, left from Rourke's modeling of the temple interior that had once controlled the recession of the light at sunset. Catherine walked over to Jackie and saw, spread out on the ledge, the recognizable shape of a dog, brown, with blue spots, and five legs. Jackie wore an expression of pride.
"Now, you see," Catherine said to her colleagues. "Isn't it wonderful and moving? There's no telling how far the child will go with proper encouragement. Think of what happens to their little souls if they are frustrated in their creative instincts. It's so important not to deny them a chance for self-expression. Did you see Jackie's face?"
Dominique's statue had been sold. No one knew who bought it. It had been bought by Ellsworth Toohey. Rourke's office had shrunk back to one room. After the completion of the Cord building, he found no work. The Depression had wrecked the building trade. There was little work for anyone. It was said that the skyscraper was finished. Architects were closing their offices. A few commissions still dribbled out occasionally, and a group of architects hovered about them with the dignity of a breadline. There were men like Ralston Holcomb among them, men who had never begged, but had demanded references before they accepted a client. When Rourke tried to get a commission, he was rejected in a manner implying that if he had no more sense than that, politeness would be a wasted effort. "Rourke," cautious businessmen said. "The tabloid hero? Money's too scarce nowadays to waste it on lawsuits afterwards." He got a few jobs, remodeling rooming houses, an assignment that involved no more than erecting partitions and rearranging the plumbing.
"Don't take it, Howard," Austin Heller said angrily. "The infernal gall of offering you that kind of work. After a skyscraper like the Cord building, after the Enright house."
"I'll take anything," said Rourke.
The Stoddard Award had taken more than the amount of his fee for the Cord building, but he had saved enough to exist on for a while. He paid Mallory's rent, and he paid for most of their frequent meals together. Mallory had tried to object.
"Shut up, Steve," Rourke had said. "I'm not doing it for you. At a time like this, I owe myself a few luxuries, so I'm simply buying the most valuable thing that can be bought, your time. I'm competing with the whole country, and that's quite a luxury, isn't it? They want you to do baby plaques, and I don't. And I like having my way against theirs."
"What do you want me to work on, Howard?"
"I want you to work without asking anyone what he wants you to work on."
Austin Heller heard about it from Mallory and spoke of it to Rourke in private.
"If you're helping him, why don't you let me help you?"
"I'd let you if you could," said Rourke. "But you can't. All he needs is his time. He can work without clients. I can't."
"It's amusing, Howard, to see you in the role of an altruist."
"You don't have to insult me. It's not altruism, but I'll tell you this. Most people say they're concerned with the suffering of others. I'm not. And yet there's one thing I can't understand. Most of them would not pass by if they saw a man bleeding in the road, mangled by a hit-and-run driver. And most of them would not turn their heads to look at Stephen Mallory. But don't they know that if suffering could be measured,
There's more suffering in Stephen Mallory when he can't do the work he wants to do than in a whole field of victims mowed down by a tank. If one must relieve the pain of this world, isn't Mallory the place to begin? However, that's not why I'm doing it. Rourke had never seen the reconstructed Stoddard Temple. On an evening in November, he went to see it. He did not know whether it was surrender to pain or victory over the fear of seeing it. It was late, and the garden of the Stoddard home was deserted. The building was dark. A single light showed in a back window upstairs. Rourke stood looking at the building for a long time. The door under the Greek portico opened, and a slight masculine figure came out. It hurried casually down the steps, and then stopped.
"Hello, Mr. Rourke," said Ellsworth Toohey quietly.
Rourke looked at him without curiosity.
"Hello," said Rourke. "Please don't run away."
The voice was not mocking, but earnest.
"I wasn't going to. I think I knew that you'd come here someday, and I think I wanted to be here when you came. I've kept inventing excuses for myself to hang about this place."
There was no gloating in the voice. It sounded drained and simple.
"Well, you shouldn't mind speaking to me. You see, I understand your work. What I do about it is another matter. You are free to do what you wish about it. I understand your work better than any living person, with the possible exception of Dominique Francone, and, perhaps, better than she does. That's a great deal, isn't it, Mr. Rourke? You haven't many people around you who can say that. It's a greater bond than if I were your devoted but blind supporter. I knew you understood. Then you won't mind talking to me. About what?"
In the darkness, it sounded almost as if Toohey had sighed. After a while, he pointed to the building and asked,
"Do you understand this?"
Rourke did not answer. Toohey went on softly,
"What does it look like to you? Like a senseless mess? Like a chance collection of driftwood? Like an imbecile chaos? But is it, Mr. Rourke? Do you see no method? You who know the language of structure and the meaning of form? Do you see no purpose here?"
"I see none in discussing it."
"Mr. Rourke, we're alone here. Why don't you tell me what you think of me? In any words you wish. No one will hear us." "But I don't think of you."
Toohey's face had an expression of attentiveness, of listening quietly to something as simple as fate. He remained silent, and Rourke asked,
"What did you want to say to me?"
Toohey looked at him, and then at the bare trees around them, at the river far below, at the great rise of the sky beyond the river.
"Nothing," said Toohey.
He walked away, his steps creaking on the gravel in the silence, sharp and even, like the cracks of an engine's pistons. Rourke stood alone in the empty driveway, looking at the building.
Part 3. Gail Wynand. Chapter 1. Gail Wynand raised a gun to his temple. He felt the pressure of a metal ring against his skin. And nothing else. He might have been holding a lead pipe or a piece of jewelry. It was just a small circle without significance. "I am going to die," he said aloud, and yawned. He felt no relief, no despair, no fear. The moment of his end would not grant him even the dignity of seriousness. It was an anonymous moment. A few minutes ago he had held a toothbrush in that hand. Now he held a gun with the same casual indifference. "One does not die like this," he thought. "One must feel a great joy or a healthy terror. One must salute one's own end. Let me feel a spasm of dread, and I'll pull the trigger." He felt nothing. He shrugged and lowered the gun. He stood tapping it against the palm of his left hand. "People always speak of a black death or a red death," he thought. "Yours, Gail Wynand, will be a gray death. Why hasn't anyone ever said that this is the ultimate horror?
Not screams, pleas, or convulsions. Not the indifference of a clean emptiness disinfected by the fire of some great disaster. But this, a mean, smutty little horror, impotent even to frighten. "You can't do it like that," he told himself, smiling coldly. "It would be in such bad taste." He walked to the wall of his bedroom. His penthouse was built above the 57th floor of a great residential hotel which he owned, in the center of Manhattan. He could see the whole city below him. The bedroom was a glass cage on the roof of the penthouse, its walls and ceiling made of huge glass sheets. There were dust-blue suede curtains to be pulled across the walls and enclose the room when he wished. There was nothing to cover the ceiling. Lying in bed, he could study the stars over his head, or see flashes of lightning, or watch the rain smashed into furious, glittering sunburst in midair above him, against the unseen protection. He liked to extinguish the lights and pull all the curtains open while he lay in bed with a woman. "We are fornicating in the sight of 6 million people," he would tell her. He was alone now. The curtains were open. He stood looking at the city. It was late, and the great riot of lights below him was beginning to die down. He thought that he did not mind having to look at the city for many more years, and he did not mind never seeing it again. He leaned against the wall and felt the cold glass through the thin, dark silk of his pajamas. A monogram was embroidered in white on his breast pocket, GW, reproduced from his handwriting, exactly as he signed his initials with a single imperial motion. People said that Gale Winans' greatest deception, among many, was his appearance. He looked like the decadent, over-perfected end product of a long line of exquisite breeding. And everybody knew that he came from the gutter. He was tall, too slender for physical beauty, as if all his flesh and muscle had been bred away. It was not necessary for him to stand erect in order to convey an impression of hardness. Like a piece of expensive steel, he bent, slouched, and made people conscious, not of his pose, but of the ferocious spring that could snap him straight at any moment. This hint was all he needed. He seldom stood quite straight. He lounged about. Under any clothes he wore, it gave him an air of consummate elegance. His face did not belong to modern civilization, but to ancient Rome, the face of an eternal patrician. His hair, streaked with gray, was swept smoothly back from a high forehead. His skin was pulled tight under the sharp bones of his face. His mouth was long and thin. His eyes, under slanting eyebrows, were pale, blue, and photographed like two sardonic white ovals. An artist had asked him once to sit for a painting of Mephistopheles. Winand had laughed, refusing, and the artist had watched sadly because the laughter made the face perfect for his purpose. He slouched casually against the glass pane of his bedroom, the weight of a gun on his palm. "Today," he thought. "What was today? Did anything happen that would help me now and give meaning to this moment?" Today had been like so many other days behind him, that particular features were hard to recognize. He was 51 years old, and it was the middle of October in the year 1932. He was certain of this much. The rest took an effort of memory. He had awakened and dressed at 6 o'clock this morning. He had never slept more than 4 hours on any night of his adult life. He descended to his dining room where breakfast was served to him. His penthouse, a small structure, stood on the edge of a vast roof landscaped as a garden. The rooms were a superlative artistic achievement. Their simplicity and beauty would have aroused gasps of admiration had this house belonged to anyone else. But people were shocked into silence when they thought that this was the home of the publisher of the New York Banner, the most vulgar newspaper in the country. After breakfast, he went to his study. His desk was piled with every important newspaper, book, and magazine received that morning from all over the country. He worked alone at his desk for 3 hours, reading and making brief notes with a large blue pencil across the printed pages. The notes looked like a spy's shorthand. Nobody could decipher them, except the dry, middle-aged secretary who entered the study when Winand left it. He had not heard her voice in 5 years, but no communication between them was necessary. When he returned to his study in the evening, the secretary and the pile of papers were gone. On his desk,
he found neatly typed pages containing the things he had wished to be recorded from his morning's work. At 10 o'clock he arrived at the Banner Building, a plain, grimy structure in an undistinguished neighborhood of Lower Manhattan. When he walked through the narrow halls of the building, the employees he met wished him a good morning. The greeting was correct, and he answered courteously. But his passage had the effect of a death ray that stopped the motor of living organisms. Among the many hard rules imposed upon the employees of all Wynand Enterprises, the hardest was the one demanding that no man pause in his work if Mr. Wynand entered the room, or notice his entrance. Nobody could predict what department he would choose to visit, or when. He could appear at any moment in any part of the building, and his presence was as unobtrusive as an electric shock. The employees tried to obey the rule as best they could, but they preferred 3 hours of overtime to 10 minutes of working under his silent observation. This morning in his office, he went over the proofs of the Banner's Sunday editorials. He slashed blue lines across the spreads he wished eliminated. He did not sign his initials. Everybody knew that only Gail Wynand could make quite that kind of blue slashes, lines that seemed to rip the authors of the copy out of existence. He finished the proofs, then asked to be connected with the editor of the Wynand Herald in Springfield, Kansas. When he telephoned his provinces, Wynand's name was never announced to the victim. He expected his voice to be known to every key citizen of his empire. "Good morning, Cummings," he said when the editor answered. "My God," gasped the editor. "It isn't."
"It is," said Wynand.
"Listen, Cummings, one more piece of crap like yesterday's yarn on the last rose of summer, and you can go back to the high school bugle."
"Yes, Mr. Wynand."
Wynand hung up. He asked to be connected with an eminent senator in Washington. "Good morning, Senator," he said when the gentleman came on the wire within 2 minutes. "It is so kind of you to answer this call. I appreciate it. I do not wish to impose on your time, but I felt I owed you an expression of my deepest gratitude. I called to thank you for your work in passing the Hayes-Langston bill."
"But, Mr. Wynand,"
the senator's voice seemed to squirm.
"It's so nice of you, but the bill hasn't been passed."
"Oh, that's right, my mistake. It will be passed tomorrow." A meeting of the board of directors of the Wynand Enterprises Incorporated had been scheduled for 11:30 that morning. The Wynand Enterprises consisted of 22 newspapers, 7 magazines, 3 news services, and 2 newsreels. Wynand owned 75% of the stock. The directors were not certain of their functions or purpose. Wynand had ordered meetings of the board always to start on time, whether he was present or not. Today he entered the boardroom at 12:25. A distinguished old gentleman was making a speech. The directors were not allowed to stop or notice Wynand's presence. He walked to the empty chair at the head of the long mahogany table and sat down. No one turned to him. It was as if the chair had just been occupied by a ghost whose existence they dared not admit. He listened silently for 15 minutes. He got up in the middle of a sentence and left the room as he had entered. On a large table in his office, he spread out maps of Stone Ridge, his new real estate venture, and spent half an hour discussing it with 2 of his agents. He had purchased a vast tract of land on Long Island, which was to be converted into the Stone Ridge Development, a new community of small homeowners, every curbstone, street, and house to be built by Gail Wynand. The few people who knew of his real estate activities had told him that he was crazy. It was a year when no one thought of building. But Gail Wynand had made his fortune on decisions which people called crazy. The architect to design Stone Ridge had not been chosen. News of the project had seeped into the starved profession. For weeks, Wynand had refused to read letters or answer calls from the best architects of the country and their friends. He refused once more when, at the end of his conference, his secretary informed him that Mr. Ralston Holcomb most urgently requested 2 minutes of his time on the telephone. When the agents were gone, Wynand pressed a button on his desk, summoning Alva Skerritt. Skerritt entered the office, smiling happily. He always answered that buzzer with the flattered eagerness of an office boy.
"Alva, what in hell is the Gallant Gallstone?"
Skerritt laughed.
"Oh, that. It's the title of a novel, by Lois Cook."
"What kind of a novel?"
"Oh, just a lot of drivel. It's supposed to be a sort of prose poem. It's all about a gallstone,
that thinks that it's an independent entity, a sort of a rugged individualist of the gallbladder, if you see what I mean, and then the man takes a big dose of castor oil. There's a graphic description of the consequences. I'm not sure it's correct medically, but anyway, that's the end of the gallant gallstone. It's all supposed to prove that there's no such thing as free will.
How many copies has it sold?
I don't know. Not very many, I think. Just among the intelligentsia. But I hear it's picked up some lately. And
precisely.
What's going on around here, Alva?
What?
Oh, you mean you noticed the few mentions, which, I mean, I've noticed it all over the banner in the last few weeks. Very nicely done, too, if it took me that long to discover that it wasn't accidental.
What do you mean?
What do you think I mean? Why should that particular title appear continuously in the most inappropriate places? One day it's in a police story about the execution of some murderer who died bravely, like the gallant gallstone. 2 days later, it's on page 16 in a state yarn from Albany. Senator Hazelton thinks he's an independent entity, but it might turn out that he's only a gallant gallstone. Then it's in the obituaries. Yesterday it was on the women's page. Today it's in the comics. Snooksy calls his rich landlord a gallant gallstone.
Scarrett chortled peacefully.
Yes. Isn't it silly?
I thought it was silly, at first. Now I don't.
But what the hell, Gale? It's not as if it were a major issue and our byliners plugged it. It's just the small fry, the $40-a-week ones.
That's the point.
One of them. The other is that the book's not a famous bestseller. If it were, I could understand the title popping into their heads automatically, but it isn't. So someone's doing the popping.
Why?
Oh, come, Gale. Why would anyone want to bother? And what do we care? If it were a political issue? But hell, who can get any gravy out of plugging for free will or against free will?
Did anyone consult you about this plugging?
No. I tell you, nobody's behind it. It's just spontaneous. Just a lot of people who thought it was a funny gag.
Who was the first one that you heard it from?
I don't know. Let me see. It was...
Yes, I think it was Ellsworth Toohey.
Have it stopped. Be sure to tell Mr. Toohey.
Okay, if you say so. But it's really nothing. Just a lot of people amusing themselves.
I don't like to have anyone amusing himself on my paper.
Yes, Gale.
At 2 o'clock, Winand arrived as guest of honor at a luncheon given by a national convention of women's clubs. He sat at the right of the chairwoman in an echoing banquet hall filled with the odors of corsages, gardenias, and sweet peas, and a fried chicken. After luncheon, Winand spoke. The convention advocated careers for married women. The Winand papers had fought against the employment of married women for many years. Winand spoke for 20 minutes and said nothing at all. But he conveyed the impression that he supported every sentiment expressed at the meeting. Nobody had ever been able to explain the effect of Gale Winand on an audience, particularly an audience of women. He did nothing spectacular. His voice was low, metallic, inclined to sound monotonous. He was too correct, in a manner that was almost deliberate satire on correctness. Yet he conquered all listeners. People said it was his subtle, enormous virility. It made the courteous voice, speaking about school, home, and family, sound as if he were making love to every old hag present. Returning to his office, Winand stopped in the city room. Standing at a tall desk, a big blue pencil in his hand, he wrote on a huge sheet of plain print stock, in letters an inch high, a brilliant, ruthless editorial denouncing all advocates of careers for women. The GW at the end stood like a streak of blue flame. He did not read the piece over. He never needed to, but threw it on the desk of the first editor in sight and walked out of the room. Late in the afternoon, when Winand was ready to leave his office, his secretary announced that Ellsworth Toohey requested the privilege of seeing him.
"Let him in," said Winand.
Toohey entered, a cautious half-smile on his face, a smile mocking himself and his boss, but with a delicate sense of balance, 60% of the mockery directed at himself. He knew that Winand did not want to see him, and being received was not in his favor. Winand sat behind his desk, his face courteously blank. Two diagonal ridges stood out faintly on his forehead, parallel with his slanting eyebrows. It was a disconcerting peculiarity which his face assumed at times. It gave the effect of a double exposure,
an ominous emphasis.
"Sit down, Mr. Toohey. Of what service can I be to you?"
"Oh, I'm much more presumptuous than that, Mr. Wynand," said Toohey gaily. "I didn't come to ask for your services, but to offer you mine."
"In what matter?"
"Stone Ridge."
The diagonal lines stood out sharper on Wynand's forehead.
"Of what use can a newspaper columnist be to Stone Ridge?"
"A newspaper columnist? None, Mr. Wynand. But an architectural expert..."
Toohey let his voice trail into a mocking question mark. If Toohey's eyes had not been fixed insolently on Wynand's, he would have been ordered out of the office at once. But the glance told Wynand that Toohey knew to what extent he had been plagued by people recommending architects, and how hard he had tried to avoid them, and that Toohey had outwitted him by obtaining this interview for a purpose Wynand had not expected. The impertinence of it amused Wynand, as Toohey had known it would.
"All right, Mr. Toohey. Whom are you selling?"
"Peter Keating."
"Well?"
"I beg your pardon?"
"Well, sell him to me."
Toohey was stopped, then shrugged brightly, and plunged in.
"You understand, of course, that I'm not connected with Mr. Keating in any way. I'm acting only as his friend. And yours."
The voice sounded pleasantly informal, but it had lost some of its certainty.
"Honestly, I know it does sound trite, but what else can I say? It just happens to be the truth."
Wynand would not help him out.
"I presumed to come here because I felt it was my duty to give you my opinion."
"No, not a moral duty. Call it an aesthetic one. I know that you demand the best in anything you do. For a project of the size you have in mind, there's not another architect living who can equal Peter Keating in efficiency, taste, originality, imagination.
That, Mr. Wynand, is my sincere opinion."
"I quite believe you."
"You do?"
"Of course. But, Mr. Toohey, why should I consider your opinion?"
"Well, after all, I am your architectural expert."
He could not keep the edge of anger out of his voice.
"My dear Mr. Toohey, don't confuse me with my readers."
After a moment, Toohey leaned back and spread his hands out in laughing helplessness.
"Frankly, Mr. Wynand, I didn't think my word would carry much weight with you, so I didn't intend trying to sell you Peter Keating."
"No? What did you intend?"
"Only to ask that you give half an hour of your time to someone who can convince you of Peter Keating's ability, much better than I can."
"Who is that?"
"Mrs. Peter Keating."
"Why should I wish to discuss this matter with Mrs. Peter Keating?"
"Because she is an exceedingly beautiful woman, and an extremely difficult one."
Wynand threw his head back and laughed aloud.
"Good God, Toohey, am I as obvious as that?"
Toohey blinked, unprepared.
"Really, Mr. Toohey, I owe you an apology if by allowing my tastes to become so well known I caused you to be so crude, but I had no idea that among your many other humanitarian activities you were also a pimp."
Toohey rose to his feet.
"Sorry to disappoint you, Mr. Toohey. I have no desire whatever to meet Mrs. Peter Keating."
"I didn't think you would have, Mr. Wynand. Not on my unsupported suggestion. I foresaw that several hours ago. In fact, as early as this morning. So I took the liberty of preparing for myself another chance to discuss this with you. I took the liberty of sending you a present. When you get home tonight, you will find my gift there. Then, if you feel that I was justified in expecting you to do so, you can telephone me, and I shall come over at once, so that you will be able to tell me whether you wish to meet Mrs. Peter Keating or not."
"Toohey, this is unbelievable. But I believe you're offering me a bribe."
"I am."
"You know, that's the sort of stunt you should be allowed to get away with completely. Or lose your job for."
"I shall rest upon your opinion of my present tonight."
"All right, Mr. Toohey. I'll look at your present."
Toohey bowed and turned to go. He was at the door when Wynand added,
"You know, Toohey, one of these days you'll bore me."
"I shall endeavor not to do so until the right time," said Toohey,
bowed again, and went out. When Wynand returned to his home, he had forgotten all about Ellsworth Toohey. That evening, in his penthouse, Wynand had dinner with a woman who had a white face, soft brown hair, and behind her, 3 centuries of fathers and brothers who would have killed a man for a hint of the things which Gale Wynand had experienced with her. The line of her arm, when she raised a crystal goblet of water to her lips, was as perfect as the lines of the silver candelabra produced by a matchless talent. And Wynand observed it with the same appreciation. The candlelight flickering on the planes of her face made a sight of such beauty that he wished she were not alive, so that he could look, say nothing, and think what he pleased. "In a month or two, Gale," she said, smiling lazily. "When it gets really cold and nasty, let's take the Idu and sail somewhere straight into the sun, as we did last winter."
Idu was the name of Wynand's yacht. He had never explained that name to anyone. Many women had questioned him about it. This woman had questioned him before. Now, as he remained silent, she asked it again.
"By the way, darling, what does it mean, the name of that wonderful mud scow of yours?"
"It's a question I don't answer," he said.
"One of them."
"Well, shall I get my wardrobe ready for the cruise?" "Green is your best color. It looks well at sea. I love to watch what it does to your hair and your arms. I shall miss the sight of your naked arms against green silk, because tonight is the last time."
Her fingers lay still on the stem of the glass. Nothing had given her a hint that tonight was to be the last time, but she knew that these words were all he needed to end it. All of Wynand's women had known that they were to expect an end like this, and that it was not to be discussed. After a while, she asked, her voice low.
"What reason, Gale?"
"The obvious one." He reached into his pocket and took out a diamond bracelet. It flashed a cold, brilliant fire in the candlelight. Its heavy links hung limply in his fingers. It had no case, no wrapper. He tossed it across the table.
"A memorial, my dear," he said. "Much more valuable than that which it commemorates."
The bracelet hit the goblet and made it ring, a thin, sharp cry, as if the glass had screamed for the woman. The woman made no sound. He knew that it was horrible, because she was the kind to whom one did not offer such gifts at such moments, just as all those other women had been, and because she would not refuse, as all the others had not refused.
"Thank you, Gale," she said,
clasping the bracelet about her wrist, not looking at him across the candles. Later, when they had walked into the drawing-room, she stopped, and the glance between her long eyelashes moved toward the darkness where the stairway to his bedroom began.
"To let me earn the memorial, Gale?"
she asked, her voice flat. He shook his head.
"I had really intended that," he said. "But I'm tired."
When she had gone, he stood in the hall and thought that she suffered, that the suffering was real. But after a while none of it would be real to her, except the bracelet. He could no longer remember the time when such a thought had the power to give him bitterness. When he recalled that he, too, was concerned in the event of this evening, he felt nothing, except wonder why he had not done this long ago. He went to his library. He sat reading for a few hours. Then he stopped. He stopped short, without reason, in the middle of an important sentence. He had no desire to read on. He had no desire ever to make another effort. Nothing had happened to him. A happening is a positive reality, and no reality could ever make him helpless. This was some enormous negative, as if everything had been wiped out, leaving a senseless emptiness, faintly indecent because it seemed so ordinary, so unexciting, like murder wearing a homey smile. Nothing was gone, except desire. No, more than that. The root, the desire to desire. He thought that a man who loses his eyes still retains the concept of sight, but he had heard of a ghastlier blindness. If the brain centers controlling vision are destroyed, one loses even the memory of visual perception. He dropped the book and stood up. He had no wish to remain on that spot. He had no wish to move from it. He thought that he should go to sleep. It was much too early for him, but he could get up earlier tomorrow. He went to his bedroom, he took a shower, he put on his pajamas. Then he opened a drawer of his dresser and saw the gun he always kept there. It was the immediate recognition, the sudden stab of interest, that made him pick it up. It was the lack of shock, when he thought he would kill himself, that convinced him he should. The thought seemed so simple, like an argument not worth contesting, like a bromide. Now he stood at the glass wall, stopped by that very simplicity. One could make a bromide of one's life, he thought, but not of one's death. He walked to the bed and sat down, the gun hanging in his hand. A man about to die, he thought, is supposed to see his whole life in a last flash. I see nothing. But I could make myself see it. I could go over it again, by force. Let me find in it either the will to live on, or the reason to end it now. Gail Winand, aged 12, stood in the darkness under a broken piece of wall on the shore of the Hudson. One arm swung back, the fist closed, ready to strike, waiting. The stones under his feet rose to the remnant of a corner. One side of it hid him from the street. There was nothing behind the other side but a sheer drop to the river. An unlighted, unpaved stretch of waterfront lay before him, sagging structures and empty spaces of sky, warehouses, a crooked cornice hanging somewhere over a window with a malignant light. In a moment he would have to fight, and he knew it would be for his life. He stood still. His closed fist, held down and back, seemed to clutch invisible wires that stretched to every key spot of his lanky, fleshless body, under the ragged pants and shirt, to the long swollen tendon of his bare arm, to the taut cords of his neck. The wires seemed to quiver. The body was motionless. He was like a new sort of lethal instrument. If a finger were to touch any part of him, it would release the trigger. He knew that the leader of the boys' gang was looking for him, and that the leader would not come alone. Two of the boys, he expected, fought with knives. One had a killing to his credit. He waited for them, his own pockets empty. He was the youngest member of the gang, and the last to join. The leader had said that he needed a lesson. It had started over the looting of the barges on the river, which the gang was planning. The leader had decided that the job would be done at night. The gang had agreed. All but Gail Winand. Gail Winand had explained, in a slow, contemptuous voice, that the little plug-uglies farther down the river had tried the same stunt last week, and had left 6 members in the hands of the cops, plus 2 in the cemetery. The job had to be done at daybreak, when no one would expect it. The gang hooted him. It made no difference. Gail Winand was not good at taking orders. He recognized nothing but the accuracy of his own judgment. So the leader wished to settle the issue once and for all. The 3 boys walked so softly that the people behind the thin walls they passed could not hear their steps. Gail Winand heard them a block away. He did not move in his corner. Only his wrist stiffened a little. When the moment was right, he leaped. He leaped straight into space without thought of landing, as if a catapult had sent him on a flight of miles. His chest struck the head of one enemy, his stomach another, his feet smashed into the chest of the 3rd. The 4 of them went down. When the 3 lifted their faces, Gail Winand was unrecognizable. They saw a whirl suspended in the air above them, and something darted at them out of the whirl with a scalding touch. He had nothing but his 2 fists. They had 5 fists and a knife on their side. It did not seem to count. They heard their blows landing with a thud, as on hard rubber. They felt the break in the thrust of their knife, which told them that it had been stopped and had cut its way out. But the thing they were fighting was invulnerable. He had no time to feel. He was too fast. Pain could not catch up with him. He seemed to leave it hanging in the air over the spot where it had hit him, and where he was no longer in the next second. He seemed to have a motor between his shoulder blades to propel his arms in 2 circles. Only the circles were visible. The arms had vanished, like the spokes of a speeding wheel. The circle landed each time, and stopped whatever it had landed upon without a break in its spin. One boy saw his knife disappear in Winand's shoulder. He saw the jerk of the shoulder that sent the knife slicing down through Winand's side and flung it out at the belt. It was the last thing the boy saw. Something happened to his chin, and he did not feel it when the back of his head struck against a pile of old bricks. For a long time the 2 others fought the centrifuge that was now spattering red drops against the walls around them, but it was no use. They were not fighting a man. They were fighting a bodiless human will. When they gave up, groaning among the bricks, Gail Winand said in a normal voice, "We'll pull it off at daybreak," and walked away. From that moment on, He was the leader of the gang. The looting of the barges was done at daybreak 2 days later, and came off with brilliant success. Gale Winand lived with his father in the basement of an old house in the heart of Hell's Kitchen. His father was a longshoreman, a tall, silent, illiterate man who had never gone to school. His own father and his grandfather were of the same kind, and they knew of nothing but poverty in their family. But somewhere far back in the line, there had been a root of aristocracy, the glory of some noble ancestor, and then some tragedy long since forgotten, that had brought the descendants to the gutter. Something about all the Winans, in tenement, saloon, and jail, did not fit their surroundings. Gale's father was known on the waterfront as the Duke. Gale's mother had died of consumption when he was 2 years old. He was an only son. He knew vaguely that there had been some great drama in his father's marriage. He had seen a picture of his mother. She did not look, and she was not dressed like the women of their neighborhood. She was very beautiful. All life had gone out of his father when she died. He loved Gale, but it was the kind of devotion that did not require two sentences a week. Gale did not look like his mother or father. He was a throwback to something no one could quite figure out. The distance had to be reckoned not in generations, but in centuries. He was always too tall for his age, and too thin. The boys called him Stretch Winand. Nobody knew what he used for muscles. They knew only that he used it. He had worked at one job after another since early childhood. For a long while, he sold newspapers on street corners. One day he walked up to the pressroom boss and stated that they should start a new service, delivering the paper to the reader's door in the morning. He explained how and why it would boost circulation. "Yeah," said the boss. "I know it will work," said Winand. "Well, you don't run things around here," said the boss. "You're a fool," said Winand. He lost the job. He worked in a grocery store. He ran errands. He swept the soggy wooden floor. He sorted out barrels of rotting vegetables. He helped to wait on customers, patiently weighing a pound of flour or filling a pitcher with milk from a huge can. It was like using a steamroller to press handkerchiefs. But he set his teeth and stuck to it. One day he explained to the grocer what a good idea it would be to put milk up in bottles, like whiskey. "You shut your trap and go wait on Mrs. Sullivan there," said the grocer. "Don't you tell me nothing I don't know about my business. You don't run things around here." He waited on Mrs. Sullivan and said nothing. He worked in a pool room. He cleaned spittoons and washed up after drunks. He heard and saw things that gave him immunity from astonishment for the rest of his life. He made his greatest effort and learned to keep silent, to keep the place others described as his place, to accept ineptitude as his master, and to wait. No one had ever heard him speak of what he felt. He felt many emotions toward his fellow men, but respect was not one of them. He worked as bootblack on a ferry boat. He was shoved and ordered around by every bloated horse trader, by every drunken deckhand aboard. If he spoke, he heard some thick voice answering, "You don't run things around here." But he liked this job. When he had no customers, he stood at the rail and looked at Manhattan. He looked at the yellow boards of new houses, at the vacant lots, at the cranes and derricks, at the few towers rising in the distance. He thought of what should be built and what should be destroyed, of the space, the promise, and what could be made of it. A hoarse shout, "Hey, boy!" interrupted him. He went back to his bench and bent obediently over some muddy shoe. The customer saw only a small head of light brown hair and two thin, capable hands. On foggy evenings, under a gas lantern on a street corner, nobody noticed the slender figure leaning against a lamppost, the aristocrat of the Middle Ages, the timeless patrician whose every instinct cried that he should command, whose swift brain told him why he had the right to do so, the feudal baron created to rule, but born to sweep floors and take orders. He had taught himself to read and write at the age of 5 by asking questions. He read everything he found. He could not tolerate the inexplicable. He had to understand anything known to anyone. The emblem of his childhood, the coat of arms he devised for himself in place of the one lost for him centuries ago, was the question mark. No one ever needed to explain anything to him twice.
He learned his first mathematics from the engineers laying sewer pipes. He learned geography from the sailors on the waterfront. He learned civics from the politicians at a local club that was a gangster's hangout. He had never gone to church or to school. He was 12 when he walked into a church. He listened to a sermon on patience and humility. He never came back. He was 13 when he decided to see what education was like and enrolled at a public school. His father said nothing about this decision, as he had said nothing whenever Gale came home battered after a gang fight. During his first week at school, the teacher called on Gale Winand constantly. It was sheer pleasure to her, because he always knew the answers. When he trusted his superiors and their purpose, he obeyed like a Spartan, imposing on himself the kind of discipline he demanded of his own subjects in the gang. But the force of his will was wasted. Within a week, he saw that he needed no effort to be first in the class. After a month, the teacher stopped noticing his presence. It seemed pointless. He always knew his lesson, and she had to concentrate on the slower, duller children. He sat, unflinching, through hours that dragged like chains, while the teacher repeated and chewed and re-chewed, sweating to force some spark of intellect from vacant eyes and mumbling voices. At the end of 2 months, reviewing the rudiments of history which she had tried to pound into her class, the teacher asked, "And how many original states were there in the Union?" No hands were raised. Then Gale Winan's arm went up. The teacher nodded to him. He rose. "Why," he asked, "should I swill everything down 10 times? I know all that." "You are not the only one in the class," said the teacher. He uttered an expression that struck her white and made her blush 15 minutes later when she grasped it fully. He walked to the door. On the threshold, he turned to add, "Oh, yes, there were 13 original states. That was the last of his formal education. There were people in Hell's Kitchen who never ventured beyond its boundaries, and others who seldom stepped out of the tenement in which they were born. But Gale Winand often went for a walk through the best streets of the city. He felt no bitterness against the world of wealth, no envy, and no fear. He was simply curious, and he felt at home on Fifth Avenue, just as anywhere else. He walked past the stately mansions, his hands in his pockets, his toes sticking out of flat-soled shoes. People glared at him, but it had no effect. He passed by and left behind him the feeling that he belonged on this street, and they didn't. He wanted nothing for the time being, except to understand. He wanted to know what made these people different from those in his neighborhood. It was not the clothes, the carriages, or the banks that caught his notice. It was the books. People in his neighborhood had clothes, horse wagons, and money. Degrees were inessential. But they did not read books. He decided to learn what was read by the people on Fifth Avenue. One day, he saw a lady waiting in a carriage at the curb. He knew she was a lady. His judgment on such matters was more acute than the discrimination of the social register. She was reading a book. He leaped to the steps of the carriage, snatched the book, and ran away. It would have taken swifter, slimmer men than the cops to catch him. It was a volume of Herbert Spencer. He went through a quiet agony trying to read it to the end. He read it to the end. He understood one quarter of what he had read, but this started him on a process which he pursued with a systematic, fist-clenched determination. Without advice, assistance, or plan, he began reading an incongruous assortment of books. He would find some passage which he could not understand.